my question for you guys this week, because we're still, we talked about, we had a C2E2 planning meeting before we recorded tonight. You guys all know that, but everybody listening doesn't know that. Anyway.
They do now.
They do now. So, obviously, we still got conventions on the brain. So, my question tonight, who is on your con bucket list? As in, who is somebody that you've wanted to meet but haven't yet? Whether it's just they haven't been at the same con as you, or, you know, they have been, but money / long line / whatever prevented you from meeting them. Lydia, I know you said that before I asked this question, you kind of knew the answer, but then you forgot the answer. Have you remembered yet?
I have not. And it sucks because I literally had this exact thought just randomly the other day, probably as I was scrolling through C2E2's list. And I was like, oh, I would really like to see this person, but I don't think I've ever seen him be at a con before. And now I cannot for the life of me think of who the heck I was thinking of. So I have no idea.
It's my fault, isn't it?
It's your fault.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'm just going to randomly think of it later and it's going to be too late.
Yeah. Yeah. You can call me. I probably won't answer because I'm a millennial. But you can call me and tell me who it is in the voicemail, and then I'll put it in the episode. You're I probably won't do that. But.
It's a nice thought.
You also brought Kevin with you to help us plan tonight. And I'm curious, Kevin, do you have an answer?
I do, because the funny thing was I laughed when Mitch asked this question because Lydia and I had this conversation about a week ago.
See, told you.
So the person that I would most want to meet at a con is Gary Oldman.
Ooh.
Only to ask him the question of, given his great long-standing career, how he feels that Commissioner Gordon is the most normal role that he has ever done.
Nice. I had a couple of different answers, but I think for me, I've been lucky enough to meet a lot of different people from Doctor Who over the years, but I have not been able to yet meet my two favorite doctors, which are Christopher Eccleston and Peter Capaldi. So it's 50-50 between them. I know that Christopher has done more cons recently, so I think of the two he would probably be the more likely of the two that I would get to meet. But still, if C2E2 announced either one of those for this year, all bets are off. Yeah, they would get literally all of my money. Matt,
so I had a couple of thoughts, so I'm gonna throw both of them out there. Alan Tudyk.
Good one.
Just because I don't think I've ever watched anything that he was in and did not enjoy the role that he played. And since you brought it up, I would have to go with David Tennant.
Even though we are talking about C2E2 right now, Alan Tudyk will be at Fan Expo Chicago, along with some of the cast of Scream. So, you down?
Not that I don't want to, but
it's a day trip. We don't have to stay overnight,
right? We'll talk about it.
Also, speaking of Alan Tudyk, but kind of off topic, have you watched Resident Alien?
I have not. It's one of the things that's. I keep seeing things online and I'm like, I need to watch this because everybody seems to love it.
Mm-hmm. We just finished season one. We're at least one episode into season two, maybe a couple episodes in season two. It's really good.
Yeah.
You'd really like it. Tabitha.
So my brain did that thing where it went on a very fun little hop, skip, jump journey. So my knee jerk reaction to this was Sarah Michelle Gellar, because she almost never does cons. And last year at C2E2, there were quite a few members of the cast of Buffy. And then I had this terrible thought that Anthony Stewarthead is not getting any younger and Giles is eventually going to die. And now I'm very sad, but also my answer is Anthony Stewarthead.
Thanks for making us all sad, Tabitha.
That's what I'm good at. Play to your strengths.
You're listening to The Geek Awakens with Mitch,
Matt,
Tabitha,
and Lydia.
All right. So we decided we weren't for sure how long we were going to be planning for C2E2. So we decided on having a shorter episode, hopefully shorter episode. So we decided to dust off Guilty Pleasure Dumpster Fire. We're going to do that in a little bit. We've got some books to talk about first. Tabitha did like the fact that I said dust off.
Nope.
But just so that you guys know what you're getting into, our Guilty Pleasure Dumpster Fire for this episode is 2000s. Cleopatra 2525, and if you've never heard of that show before, you're in good company. And this was a trip, y'all.
Yeah.
Like, I so not Seth and I watched this on Monday, and we only watched the first three episodes. That's all we're going to talk about. But after we watched the first three episodes, I messaged the rest of the group. I was like, guys, I'm willing to call an audible. Here's what we experienced. This, and this. If you guys don't want to do this, I am okay with it. And so I put the ball in your court, and you guys all were like, meh, whatever. So
it's our fault.
I am not completely to blame for what happened here. I just want you to know. So with that, let's open up the pull list. What's on our pull list this week? So we've got a few books to talk about this week. The first one is A Fox in My Brain. It's out April 16th from Fair Square Comics. It's by Lou Luby. So this is an autobiographical graphic novel. It tells Lou's story of living with cyclothemia. It's a mood disorder that went undiagnosed and misdiagnosed for years. I am about halfway through this book, and I desperately want to go back and finish it. We talked last week, actually, about another, on paper, similar book. An autobiographical book about somebody living with a mood disorder. And while I enjoyed both books, these books could not be more different. With A Fox in My Brain, there was a lot of humor attached to it. Not to say that Lou doesn't take this seriously, but like, I think you need a type of brevity with a situation like this. And she definitely gives it. It was very interesting, you know, kind of like seeing her go through all these issues of going through different, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, you know, whatever. And people being like, oh, you're too young or too pretty or whatever to be depressed, or, you know, oh, you definitely have this, but have fun, you know. You could really read the frustration on the page with this book. I feel bad for comparing the two books, but like with the book that we read last week, it was, I don't want to say more informative, but that's kind of how I felt with reading that. With A Fox in My Brain, it's definitely informative. You know, I'm definitely learning a lot, but I guess it's almost less overt than the book that we read last week, you know? But yeah, like I said, I really, I do say this a lot where I'm like, oh, yeah, I can't wait to finish reading this. And then I don't because I'm me. But I really, really want to go back and finish this. Matt, I saw you shaking your head a lot, so I'm assuming you agree with me. But what did you think?
No, yeah, I definitely agree with you. This, like you said, not to compare the book from last week and this week, because they're very different, but they tackle somewhat similar issues. Last week was, I guess the easiest way I can think to put it is that last week's took a more clinical approach to bipolar disorder. And the Fox in My Brain this week took a more creative and storytelling aspect or storytelling feel to it. So while it was quite informative, I learned a lot. There's a lot of information that gets put on the page in front of you. There's more of a beginning and an beginning, middle, and an end story wise to this one. I don't know. I also enjoyed. I hate to say enjoyed because it's like a struggle that she went through, but the personification is not the right word because it's an animal. anthropomorphosis? I don't know. Whatever.
We'll go with personification.
Right. But giving the fox a form. And I thought that was a clever way to do that, to kind of talk about it. I don't know. Overall, I really enjoyed this. It is, like last week, it's very informative. I think I like this one overall maybe a little bit more, just because it's not so clinical. There's a story there, but still wonderful and definitely worth the read.
Tabitha, we're in similar situations where we are not finished with this book, but what are your thoughts so far?
I am enjoying how this one is told, I think, more than I enjoyed the other one, if we're making the comparison between those two. I did enjoy the art, I think, more of the other one, because it felt more like the art was actually portraying the feeling. This one felt more just like a comic book than the previous one did. The struggle with the diagnosis in this one was very interesting to watch play out on page. And I think I said this last time that we talked about one of these biographical mental health graphic novels. Like, if this is how they need to get out into the universe to make people more aware of the struggles that people go through with their mental health, then I think that's great. I think this is a great outlet for that. And I hope there are more. The personification of the... That is not the word I'm looking for, and I can't think of what the... I was trying to think of the word, too. Utilizing the fox to represent that was so clever and so well done.
Clever like a fox?
Jesus Christ. yes. I want to go home and finish this.
So next up is When I Arrived at the Castle. It's out now from Silver Sprocket by Emily Carroll. A woman arrived at the Countess's castle to kill her, a task many have failed to do. However, she is not prepared for what the Countess has planned. Matt and I both read it. We're both not entirely sure what we read, but Matt, why don't you start?
I'm not really sure what I read. I almost want to go back and read this again. I actually really enjoyed the art. This is, I know, Mitch, you're not a fan at all of black and white comics.
Some red, though.
This is black, white, and red. And it felt a lot like Sin City, in the fact that the red was used very deliberately to accent and to show, there's a fair amount of blood in this, but yeah, like, For a purpose. Like, it was a highlight. This is definitely a bizarre story. Like I said, I'm not really sure what I read, but I didn't not enjoy the time that I spent reading it. So,
No, I kind of feel that. You're right about the art. Like, the art matches the story very well. I was confused at first because, so like, the other character, which I don't think she's named in this.
I'm not.
Yeah. Sure. But like, which I went back and kind of looked at the first few pages again, and yes, the first few pages, like, it is made abundantly clear. The other character is a cat, or at least cat-like. I didn't catch that at first.
Yeah.
So, like, when I read it the first time, about midway through, like, when I realized that this is, like, a cat-like person, I'm like, wait, when did this happen? But then I go back, and it's very evident from, like, when she first appears on page. So I think that kind of lends itself more to, like, when I was reading it, I was kind of reading it a little bit faster, because, you know, I'm reading this to review, you know, so maybe I should have taken a step back and, like, enjoyed it for what it was and really take my time with it. But yeah, like, at the end of the day, like, I ended this book thinking that I knew what was going on, but even now, like, 24 hours later or so, like, I'm still not 100% for sure what was going on.
No.
The next book is Beyond Real, number 3. It's out April 17th from Vault, written by Zach Kaplan, with art by Fabiana Mascolo. So June and her new allies reach a world with no humanity, but nature is personified. Seemingly impossible to move forward. Will June finally get to the source? Lydia, you said you've read this. What are your thoughts?
So I actually went back and reread 1 and 2 because it had been a while. One thing that didn't really strike me until about halfway through the second one going into the third one was the fact that every time they, like, shift to a new area, the art style completely changes.
Mm-hmm. It's a different artist each issue.
Which I realized after I got through it. I really like this one, especially with, like, the talking trees and all that fun stuff. I really want to kind of see where this goes, because the way it ends is very much of a cliffhanger, and I feel like we're getting closer to, like, finding out, one, how she even got in this, like, other world, or, like, why she's there and how this is going to help Eli in the end. So I want to see where this goes. This is one that actually is really keeping my attention.
Yeah. I did the same thing. Because I had not gotten around to reading issue 2 yet. But I reread issue 1. Because I was like, I kind of remembered what was going on, but not enough. And I was like, okay, I need to do this series justice. especially with issue 3. Is this giving you Wizard of Oz vibes?
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit.
The talking tree.
Yeah. But yeah, I am really loving this story. I've said before, and I'm sure I'll say again the next time we talk about a Zach Kaplan book, like, I'm becoming a Zach Kaplan fanboy. I've loved every book of his that I've read. And this is no exception. Like, I think we had talked about it before where, like, we maybe weren't sure how this was going to play off with having a different artist each issue, because that can be jarring. That can be, I don't want to say confusing, but it can really throw you off. This series does that very well. It's very deliberate.
I feel like a lot of the problems that a lot of books have like that try to throw in multiple artists is it's multiple art styles with one solid, like, story setting.
Mm-hmm.
This one, with it switching to different, like, worlds or, like, sections of this world that she's in as it goes, I think helps, like, make that transition easier.
Yeah. There were a couple of moments in this issue, and I'm not going to say them on air because I don't want to potentially spoil anything, but there were a couple of moments in this issue that maybe have given me ideas of where this story is going, and while I'm sure it's going to be very well done, I feel we might be in for a good cry.
Oh, I'm sure we're going to be.
Come the end of whether this is a 4-issue miniseries, a 6-issue miniseries, whatever the case may be. I feel like when we hit that last page, a tear may fall on the page. And while I will applaud Zach Claflin for a job well done, I will be very angry for him making me feel emotions.
Yeah, that's fair.
Last book that we're going to talk about is, speaking of finales, Jill and the Killers, number 4. We talked about number 3 last week, but here we are. We're at the finale. It's out April 17th from Oni Press, written by Olivia Quintero Briggs, with art by Roberta Ingranata. In this final issue, it's a race against time for Jill and her friends to save O'Brien and solve the murders of the other missing students along the way. But doing so may put them in more danger than they planned on. I am conflicted with this last issue. It gave us a satisfying end to them rescuing O'Brien. It gave us a satisfying end to, to finding these other things. But there were a couple of loose ends that were definitely not tied up. And it's going to be one of those things where, and this definitely lends itself to more issues, definitely another mini series. Definitely lends itself to that, where those other loose ends will probably be tied up. However, if we don't get more of this, I will be very mad. But that said, for this mini series, especially with them assumingly planning to have more, I think that they did a really good job of keeping that interest there, not giving you your entire meal. Like, you're still like, but what's for dessert? I did think there was a really sweet moment with Jill and Clyde, who have been beefing for the past 3 issues. And again, I don't want to spoil anything, but that was very nice. That was very satisfying. I really can't say enough good things about this book. I think, especially now that we've seen the entire series, I think this is going to be one of those that I go back and reread start to finish, and not taking, month-long breaks in between the issues to really get a good feel for it. Matt, what did you think?
The idea of going back and reading this in one sitting is probably the one thing that would alleviate the one gripe I had with the final book. Is as much as I enjoyed the journey, I enjoyed the resolution. There were a few parts to that resolution that seemed a little out of left field. I know that the hints were there, but because it has been so long since we read issue 1 and 2, I had almost forgotten about those being crumbs along the trail or puzzle pieces. So I almost wish that those had been a little bit more prevalent throughout the entire series, throughout the entire 4 issues. But I did kind of like how it was kind of a twist. It took that thriller vibe and gave you the twisted ending. The moment with Clyde, I did appreciate. My only issue with that was that they fell back into the youth speak in that scene, and I had to slow down and reread that a couple of times to make sure that I understood the context of the conversation.
Get your translator.
Yeah, exactly. My Urban Dictionary translator. And it does leave the door open for more. And I don't think that's a bad thing. Overall, I really enjoyed the series. I'm glad we got all four issues to read and see how it went from beginning to end. I don't know. I enjoyed it. It's one of those, like, I'm not going to be upset if there aren't more, but if there are more, it's going to be a good thing.
My question is, if there's more, are they all going to sound like it's about an 80s rock band?
Probably.
Yeah. All right, guys, we've held out long enough. Let's go into Guilty Pleasure Dumpster Fire.
Is it a guilty pleasure or is it a dumpster fire?
So, like most awful things in the world, this edition of Guilty Pleasure Dumpster Fire is all thanks to Facebook. So, a few weeks ago, I was scrolling and came across a seemingly harmless Gina Torres appreciation post. It had pictures of her in a bunch of different shows, had like logos for each of the shows. I recognized most of them, even if I hadn't seen them. You know, I was still like, oh yeah, I remember that show, you know, whatever. Except for one. Cleopatra 2525. And then I fell down a deep rabbit hole. I was at work and I pulled Tabitha down the rabbit hole. Like, you can attest to like just how invested I was that day.
He came barreling like out of his office and was like, oh my God, have you heard about this? And I'm like, no. So he proceeds to sit down at my desk and we proceed to watch the opening and like the first 5 minutes maybe of the first episode. And we're both just like mouths open, staring at the phone screen. And I'm like, what is happening? And he is like, geeked. He's like, this is gonna be great for Guilty Pleasure Dumpster Fire. And I'm like, well, it's already a dumpster fire, so sure.
And then they proceed to spam our group chat with like paragraph after paragraph about this thing.
Yep.
We were very productive at work that day.
If our bosses are listening, sorry.
We were on a break.
Okay, Ross.
So, Cleopatra 2525 centers around three women in the year, you guessed it, 2525. Hel and Sarge are part of a human resistance against the Baileys, a robot force who took over the Earth centuries ago, forcing humans underground. The two find Cleopatra... I shit you not, a stripper from the early 2000s who dies from a boob job gone wrong and becomes cryogenically frozen. Now, like, those words in that order does not happen often. So, the show stars Gina Torres as Hel, Victoria Pratt as Sarge, and Jennifer Sky as Cleo. So, Gina is arguably the most famous or the most well-known of the three. Clearly, we all know her from Firefly, Serenity, whatever. She also had roles in The Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions, as well as Angel, Boston Legal, Westworld, Pearson, bunch more. Also, Cleopatra 2525 won an award.
A Razzie?
No. So, thanks. So, Gina Torres won the ALMA, which is the American Latino Media Arts Award, for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Syndicated Drama Series in 2001.
Huh.
So, we are talking about award-winning Cleopatra 2525. So...
Not such a bad boob job now, is it?
Right? So, Victoria went on to star in Mutant X. She also had minor roles in Lie to Me, Castle, Hawaii Five-O, and more. Also, in 2019, she married Trace Adkins.
Huh.
Right?
That's why she looks familiar.
Before starring as Cleopatra, Jennifer also had roles in Buffy, General Hospital, and Xena. Since then, Hers is the smallest filmography. Her last role was in 2005 on CSI Miami. However, she has gone on to document how working as a teenage model gave her PTSD. She also fought for better working conditions for those in the fashion industry. So, Cleopatra 2525 ran for two seasons from 2000 to 2001. It aired in syndication alongside another show, Jack of All Trades. The two were half-hour shows. When Jack of All Trades was canceled after its first season, Cleopatra 2525 switched to hour-long episodes. A lot of people on the production crew also worked on Xena and Hercules. So that's why, like, it kind of gave that feel in a lot of spots. Sam Raimi, yes, that Sam Raimi, was also an EP on the show. The theme song, which arguably is the best part of this show, is a reworked version of the song in the year 2525. The version for the show is sung by Gina Torres. So we watched the first three episodes of Cleopatra 2525. I think I mentioned this earlier, but we did this to get a decent idea if this show is indeed a guilty pleasure or a dumpster fire. As a final note, most, if not the entire series, is available on Internet Archive. If you're not familiar with this, this is a really good resource. There are a lot of other, like, forgotten television shows that are on this website, as well as just a lot of other things that, for better or worse, maybe have been forgotten. But yeah, definitely recommend checking out Internet Archive. So, how we're going to do it this week. I've written down brief synopses for each of the three episodes, and we're just going to kind of like give our thoughts about each of those episodes. Before we do that, though, going into this, I want, like, what were your thoughts? What were your feelings right before you hit play that first episode? Lydia, you're already going towards the mic.
Honestly, my first thought was, oh boy, what's Mitch getting us into this time? And my thoughts were not wrong.
No. Tabitha, what about you?
I mean, I already knew what to expect because, like I said, you forced me to watch the first 5 minutes of this.
You did it very willingly.
Under slight duress, but it's okay. I kind of knew what to expect. I don't think I knew how weird it was going to get.
Matt, what about you?
Your initial enthusiasm in the group chat and then trepidation and concern based on the items bullet pointed about what you ran across in those first three episodes made me deeply concerned for what I was in for.
So the first episode, it's called Quest for Firepower. Hell, Sarge, and Horst go to the surface to test a new shield against the Baileys. In doing so, they discover Horst is a betrayer, which a betrayer is basically, he's kind of a Bailey. Basically, he's a robot. So, Sarge gets injured in the process of fighting Horst. She and Hell go to get medical attention, where they meet Cleopatra, who wakes up from a long nap. They rescue Cleo, who ends up helping as they take down the betrayer. I've talked a lot. Tabitha, let's get your thoughts on this first episode.
So like I said, I kind of knew what to expect from the very beginning of this. And if I'm being super honest with you, we watched them all back to back to back, so they all kind of blur in my head. This first episode, however, the thing that stands out for me the most is the scene where they have to go find Sarge a new kidney because she's been laser shot. And this is where they discover Cleopatra. Not going to lie to you, when you were first telling me about this, I was like, is this like a thing where they're like underground and they like come across Cleopatra's tomb and like they revive her? Because, you know, Cleopatra 2525, no, it's just some bimbo with a boob job. It was very disappointing for me. However, how hard they leaned into the like mummy wrapping of her in that first episode was classic. That scene, however, where she's waking up, there is this very creepy, rapey joke that is made.
There's two of them.
I missed the second one, apparently. I only caught the first one, or maybe I caught the second one. Made by the lion furry guy. However, I will say, if I could just go see some furry lion and get a backwoods kidney from a cryogenically frozen bimbo, I'd get one.
And it only costs you a little stick of wood, too.
Yeah, right? I've got tied, like, I got a tree out in the yard. I can bring him some sticks of wood. I have so many issues with the portrayal of these poor women in the show. Like, what kind of monster wrote this? Oh, yeah. It's just... I will say I think the first episode might have been the most tame out of all three.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna leave that there.
I don't remember exactly what he said the first time, but the second time, like, he's talking to I'm talking about the furry right now. He's talking to
Thank you for clarifying.
To Hell and Sarge, not Surge. man, I miss that soda. But, like, basically, like, saying how he doesn't want to give her up, you know, like, whatever. But then he's like, yeah, let me know if she wakes up. And it's like, I'm saying this, but, like, know that I'm saying it with, like, shifty eyes. Like, but yeah, I don't. He says something, too, about how, like, boys could get lonely, too, or something like that. Like,
that was the one I caught. Yeah.
It was just that part was filled with ick. The CGI does not age well.
No.
At all. The acting is not great. Cleopatra screams a lot in this first episode.
She screams a lot.
Period. Yeah, I was about to say it doesn't get better. But yeah, like, this is it's whew. Man, she screams a lot. But all things aside, like, and we'll kind of go back to it, or at least I kind of keep going back to it. Like, I guess there is a reason why, like, Gina Torres does act as well as she can for what she is given with this series. She does really well. I really don't know what else to say. I don't. Lydia.
Yeah, so basically everything you guys have already said. Can we just talk about how cringy some of the 2000s, like, terms and, like, quotes she was coming up with were?
Now, see, I liked that, though. And especially because, like, how Hell and Sarge, like, didn't recognize those. I thought, believe it or not, I thought that was clever.
It was. For about the first, like, 30 seconds of it. And then it's like, okay, you're overdoing it. Just stop. I still have questions. Because, like, if her boob job was botched that bad that she, like, died, how are her boobs that good?
Yeah, like,
but she wakes. Sorry, she wakes up and, like, peeks under her wrap
her
and
shirt.
Is like, "Oh, okay, good job."
Yeah, no,
like,
yeah.
She compliments it. It was so bad that she died.
My assumption was that the anesthesia went wrong, but also cryogenically freezing someone is very expensive. Why are they wasting it on her? Who chose that?
I mean, she still made good money.
They saved money on the bedding. It was just an egg crate.
I mean, I guess we did learn in episode 3 she's not very good at stripping, but we'll get to that.
So then there's also the fact that, you know, her, like, medical gauze that's, like, covering her new boob job is, like, this weird little dress. It's like, that's not how this works at all. But yeah, she screams so freaking much. Like, I was wearing earbuds watching this, and I almost took them out because it was hurting my head.
I'm glad you didn't.
You're welcome. Yeah. The CGI did not age well. And, like, the overall, like, feel I got of this just from the first episode was, like, a mixture of, like, the cheesiness of, like, Power Rangers, like, fight scenes mixed with some weird sci-fi video game from the early 2000s. And I'm not sure how I feel about it.
Complete aside, but I was on Wikipedia, you know, putting together my notes, and there is, like, there was a link that to the original website. Granted, like, you click the link and it takes you, like, the Wayback Machine, but still, it was, like, the website for Cleopatra 2525, and I almost got lost on that rabbit hole, but I pulled myself out very quickly, so there's that. Matt, what are your thoughts?
There's so many things. I don't know how they all didn't have to have rotator cuff surgery with the kickback for those wrist blasters. Like, all they did was, like, punch backwards.
Don't forget the humping,
though. Oh, yeah. Sergeant her reverse humping when she was shooting. I couldn't help but notice, one, their aim is awful, and two, all they did was, like, punch backwards every time they shot. It's, like, a little aggressive. The other thing I did notice is that security underground is crap. Everybody just walks into everywhere. Like, there was, like, oh, let's go fix her kidney. Oh, wait, the bad guy's just going to waltz right in. Like, nobody stops anybody. Like, there's no, like, are you hiding? Is this supposed to be a secure location? Because it's obviously not.
Yeah. I just remembered there was one part where we find out that Cleopatra is really good at imitating voices. Yeah. And so, like, there's like the final battle or whatever with the betrayer, and, like, he's attacking Sarge, and Hel tells Cleopatra to, you know, like, talk like Sarge to distract him. But, like, Not-Seth points out, like, dude is still, like, he's got eyes focused on Sarge. What good is that going to do?
I don't know. Maybe it's his Walmart Terminator vibe that he had going on. Because it wasn't even that. It was, like, Dollar General. Like, he changes into, like, that molten metal.
Silver Surfer.
Yeah. Like, a bad mix between Richard Patrick's Terminator and Silver Surfer. And, like, wait a minute.
Betrayers really dug the dog into squirrel.
Right. And, like, also the whole, like, when they're jumping down the shafts, like, that's honestly probably intentional.
Yeah.
But, like, I was so confused at first. It's like, what are they flying? Like, I didn't appreciate that they were, like, jumping down.
Falling.
And, like, how do you go the other way, all the way?
They have to use their web shooters.
I know, yeah. But, like,
thanks, Sam.
What if you? What if, like, you know what? I'm getting caught up in the physics. I can't do this.
Don't, because they obviously didn't.
My brain is, like, spinning out already, so I need to stop thinking about that.
All right.
Well, my question is: does everybody have these little web slingers? Like, how do people get around? Are they the only ones that do this?
Yeah, there were people in some of the other episodes that didn't have those. Like, do you just live in your own little box down the shaft? Well,
I mean, they only ever go up or down. They never really go, like, out. So, like, they all these the entire human population lives underground, but they all apparently live in this one shaft that just goes all the way to the Earth's core, because other than, like, going to one room off the side of this elevator shaft, like, they don't ever go anywhere else.
But then the top is the Sistine Chapel somehow. I don't...
Which it opens into a field.
Correct. As it should. I don't... Like I said, the physics. My brain is...
So, to kind of explain a little bit further. So, like, Hel has an earpiece. And basically, Hel, Sarge, and then later Cleopatra are the angels to this voice that is called Voice.
So clever.
Charlie. If we're making a Charlie's Angels comparison. So you learn later on in the series, and I have not seen any more than the first three episodes, but you learn later on in the series that there are more teams like Hel and Sarge and Cleopatra. So there have to be other shafts and other teams down said shaft.
Mm. We've said the word shaft enough now. It's banned.
It's been canceled.
Yes.
All right, so let's move on to episode two, which is called Cregan. So the team's Mandroid, Mauser, is kidnapped by Cregan, who killed Hel's family. Cleo and Sarge must help Hel, who was attacked by Cregan, and save Mauser before all of his secrets are downloaded to Cregan's systems. Cregan is basically going to be the big bad of this series. When doing notes for this, episode two for me was kind of like the one that I kept forgetting about. You know, even though you had this introduction of this big villain who had like a Jay Leno chin. he looked like the guy from Big Bad Beetleborgs. That also kind of looked like Jay Leno.
Oh.
The
clown dude.
Yeah. Which, Lil Baby Mitch, when that show was first going on, thought that that was actually Jay Leno. I thought that he was acting in Big Bad Beetleborgs, but I digress. So, granted, maybe it was because I was watching these episodes, you know, in real quick succession, but it does say something when you're introducing somebody who's potentially going to be a big villain, and I don't really remember that episode, you know? I really, like, even kind of going back, like, there was, like, this really weird part where, like, Cleopatra has to get the voice thing out of Hel, and so she's doing surgery on this woman.
While Sarge is busy shooting bad guys.
Okay. Yeah.
I've never even played a surgeon before.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, by the way, apparently she was, like, an aspiring actress as well, so, like, all the, like, stereotypes in one character here.
I was about to say, like, I know this may get me canceled, but, like, aren't most strippers aspiring actresses?
That's what I'm saying.
So, yeah, like, I don't have many notes for this episode. Tabitha, what about you?
This one, again, like you said, was kind of the least memorable. I don't know if it was because it was in the middle or if because my brain was shutting down by this point. I could have done without the creepy clown. I also could have done without Mauser laying on the table getting downloaded with this entrails dangling down the table. I was like, what is that? Oh, it's a spinal cord. What is that? And, like, as much as I love, like, a fun backstory, they, like, gave you a backstory. Like, they give you a backstory in, like, a bad B horror movie. Like, you killed my parents. And then that's all you know about it. It's also giving Batman vibes, especially since he kind of looks like Dollar Tree Joker. Had a baby with Harley Quinn, and then this is the procreation of that mess. I think my biggest issue with this particular episode was probably the if they are going to make Cregan, and I'm not continuing on with the show, so we'll never know, the big bad, they did a crappy job of making me care. I just wanted the creepy clown to go away, and then like they blow him into this closet, and then he's but then they open it and he's gone, and they're like, but he got away. And the whole thing with the, like, operating on her on the fly while they're being protected by Sarge and her humping gun. Like, if there's ever anything in my brain that needs, or near my brain that needs to be removed, you know who not to give a laser knife to? Someone like Cleopatra. Jesus Christ. And then the whole thing in the beginning with like her, like, I made my outfit fun. And they're like, these outfits are practical. And she's like, okay, so the bared midriff is...
Yeah, that was
is tactical. Okay, like that was a good cut. Like that was great. Yeah, this middle episode just kind of felt like filler. So
again, like I completely forgot, like that really awkward like rubdown that Bowser was giving Sarge in the beginning. Yeah. Like, okay, so when Not Seth and I were starting this, I accidentally clicked on the second episode first, and so we're like 30 seconds into it, and he's like, is this a porno?
Yeah,
and
I'm like, gratuitous butt shot.
Right. I'm like, no? Maybe?
Mark?
Matt, what are your thoughts on Cregan?
He looks like Ronald McDonald on crack.
Oh my God.
Quite honestly, like, I kept looking at him, and all I could picture is... So... In Overwatch, there's God knows how many characters. One of them is Junkrat, and he has a jester costume or a skin that you can get. And all I could think of is that this looks like Junkrat's jester skin from Overwatch. Like, that was all I saw every time he was on screen. I don't know if maybe that was the inspiration for that skin or that costume in the video game. I feel like it might be, because that's the way video game designers work. They pull random shit from God knows where that you've never even heard about. But I'm with Tabitha that, like, if he's supposed to be the big bad, they gave you that, like, 30-second backstory that's supposed to make you have this, like, visceral, like, oh, I see why they're at each other's throats. And it just, it fell flat.
Lydia, what'd you think?
I'm too busy trying to figure out what's going through Kevin's head right now, because I just showed him a picture of what okay. Cregan looks like.
So I had zero context for any of this. I was saved because Lydia couldn't figure out how to watch it on the TV. So she watched it on her phone, and she said she was going to put her earbuds in as to not disturb me. For the next 90 minutes, I heard gasps, I heard laughter, I heard angry sounds. At one point, she paused it and showed me a still of the three girls running. Gina Torres was the only one I recognized, and I said, oh, now I know how Jessica Pearson paid for law school. And no, she just showed me a picture of Cregan, and my first initial thought was, oh, it's inner city Pennywise.
You're not wrong.
Yep.
Yeah, the beginning, like, awkward rubdown was, yeah, I was not sure where that was going. I'm glad that it stopped where it did. The fact that she took the pockets out of her outfit made me so mad. Like, how are you going to get a skirt that has pockets and take them off? What is wrong with you?
Wasn't practical.
Well, clearly, what's wrong with these girls? This one, like I said earlier, with like the kind of cheesy like fight scenes and like little henchmen kind of characters, like you would get from like Power Rangers or something like that. This one was so bad with that, because all the little like henchmen that Cregan had with him are just like, oh, well. The download failed, and yeah, we lost everything. He just gives him that look like, you're so incompetent. It's like, well, you hired them, so what did you expect? The problem I was having was I liked Kreegan as a character, and then every time I looked at his face, I was like, this does not match. And I got mad, because it's like, you have the makings of a decent villain. Why do you have to look like this? It's the myth.
He had too much teeth to be on meth. So that's
yeah. Yeah. So like,
it's new meth.
I mean, you're right. In 500 years, they have done wonders with meth, guys.
So, and yeah, like you guys said, the whole like 20, 30 seconds of backstory you get, and then that's all you get of anything that he has to do, like with Hell's backstory and all that's like, I want more because I want to care about why you guys hate each other. But now you're thrown out a window and you're gone. So, bye, I guess.
Which leads us to episode 3, which was
it was special.
It was
something.
Episode 3 is called Flying Lessons. With the help of Hell and Sarge, Cleo is learning to fly in the shafts.
I told you. We talked about shafts.
It's what they're called. I can't help it.
Find a new word.
That could be dangerous.
When she sees a girl kidnapped, Cleo convinces the others to go on a rescue mission to a slave trader bar. Hell plays a game to win back the girl, as well as the others held in captivity. But it may be more than she bargained for.
Wow. The fact that there's a pun in the synopsis.
Of course. I mean, I wrote the synopsis. What more do you expect? Yeah. I wrote that expecting a shame, and I didn't get one.
To be fair, I'm too lazy to reach for my bell.
Just saying, you haven't given a shame in a minute. So, Tabitha, what were your thoughts on flying lessons?
Oh, Jesus Christ. So, of all the episodes that we watched, all three of them, which felt like 300... this was definitely the strangest. I want to know how this aired on TV, because this is like, they are straight up in BDSM land in this episode, like for the whole thing. The guy is wearing nipple hats. I don't know what you would call them. There are people on leashes with ball gags and masks and ropes and chains, and I'm not here to yick anybody's yum, but like, I don't need to see that in syndicated TV. Like, that feels too spicy. There were so many very uncomfortable moments, and I'm just having this vision of like a teenager being like, Mom, I want to watch this show back in 2000. Now, you want to sit down and watch it with me? And then that's what they pull up, is this third episode of Cleopatra 2525. We get to learn about Cleo's dancing skills in this episode, which I not good. She was an aspiring actress and apparently also an aspiring stripper. however, the people in 2525 are very impressed by her skill abilities, mostly because the dancer that was standing on the stage before her was literally just like leaning on the pole. And she was like, this isn't how you do this. And I'm like, well, no, but what you're doing is not how you do it either. So
also, can we talk about the song that was playing while she was doing it? Like who dances to that song?
Like, yeah, it was something about like prostitution being the old, like, I was trying to listen to it, but I was there were so many things happening, and the villain from this episode, the like slave trader, his teeth were yellow, like, and rat teeth. They were yellow rat teeth, and he kept like flicking his tongue, and I kept getting nauseous. So this was just a bunch of shit that I didn't want to look at. Like, that's what should have been the title of this episode. A bunch of shit that you don't want to look at. Batman's saggy hat nipples, didn't need to see that. Batman's tongue in his teeth, didn't need to see that. Gina Torres pretending to be drunk and macking out with random humans, didn't need to see that.
Yeah.
Didn't need any of this.
Also, like, what they were playing, I called it the wrong thing to you guys. I called it Space Kerplunk. Which
that's what I called it.
Which is accurate, except like they're not really in space, so it's just futuristic Kerplunk. But but yeah, like the slave trader guy, like his tongue did not need to be out nearly as much as it as it was. Yeah, the BDSM gimp suits. We're just, it was bizarre. And I guess, yes, if we're talking about these are like sex slave trading or, you know, whatever, like, okay, so I get that to an extent, but even still, like, they were taking it to the extreme. And you're absolutely right, Tabitha. Like, syndication or not, how did this end up on television in 2000? Yeah, the Cleopatra dancing, it's like, okay, girl, so we know that you weren't good at it. I understand. It's fine. So, like, I did kind of like how, like, at the beginning of this episode when this girl's kidnapped, how Cleopatra, like, basically talks Hel and Sarge into helping to save this girl. And I feel like this is going to lend itself kind of to longer in the series where, you know, not only do Hel and Sarge, you know, help slash, you know, like change Cleopatra to adjust to her new life, but Cleopatra is probably going to, you know, change Hel and Sarge, you know, for the better or what have you. So that part, you know, like I was like, okay, I'm here for this. There was one part later on. So like the girl that gets kidnapped, like Cleopatra is talking to her father. And so, like, the dad, like, ends up in this sex bar. Cleopatra keeps calling him daddy, which was really weird.
I forgot about that. And as we know, that is Matt's favorite word. So he was, like, visibly and physically cringing every time it was happening.
Yeah.
Least favorite part. It's just saying something.
I did also think that it was kind of funny that I think this was when Cleopatra went to go do her little dance. And at that point, Hel was doing really good. And then she comes back from her dance and Hel was like, oh, by the way, I accidentally lost you and Sarge.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, that's kind of funny. But yeah, this episode was just, I don't know how this episode came to be. I really don't. This was over the top. Lydia.
I think I spent a good chunk of this episode just cringing at my phone. There was so much of this episode that just made me super uncomfortable. Like you said, with the creepy dude with the tongue thing and like, there was a couple things that did make me laugh. One of them being, like you said, oh, by the way, I lost you both. And then just panning to Sarge and that little grimace that she gives Cleo, like, yeah, get over here. Feel like this episode did not need to be this
explicit
is a good word. They could have been so much more clothed and it would have been fine. Probably my least favorite of the three episodes that we watched.
We survived Y2K. The censors were like, why not?
Basically. I mean, this was pre 9/11, and I feel like there was that like kind of like moment where, you know, things were
a little more wild.
A little, yeah. I was gonna say a little looser, but Matt,
those outfits were definitely not. The only thing about this episode that I enjoyed was the space kerplunk. And I kind of want to know how to play. But, like, that moment where Gina Torres is, like, uninhibited because of the beverage that she had, and she pulls one of those little lasers with her teeth. Like, what? Like, it was just, like, everything about this episode was over the top.
Also, can we talk about the fact that, like, the creepy dude looked at her like he was uncomfortable in that situation? Right. Like, have you looked around, yeah, dude?
Read the room, guy.
Right. Right? The guy with the leather mask with horns. That's cool. But her pulling the laser out with her teeth, that's too much?
Yeah. Well, like, to be fair, who else has touched that, you know?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, like, unhygienic.
There we go. There it is.
There are still germs on 2525, guys. Just saying.
I guess all I can really say is that this was, for better or for worse, the most memorable of the three episodes that we watched.
So now it's time. Is Cleopatra 2525 a guilty pleasure or a dumpster fire? He hasn't given his opinions on the other episodes, but I do think since he did suffer through them all, that is only fair to let Not Seth give his opinion on whether or not this is a guilty pleasure or a dumpster fire.
I think this is the closest that America will come to having its own Doctor Who, so I'm going to say it's a guilty pleasure.
Would you like to elaborate on why you think it's America's Doctor Who?
I'll be taking no further questions. I don't know. It's just, it's that really weird, like, Russell T. Davies, like, early Doctor Who in the reboot, where it's just like, there's money that went into this, but should there have been? Like, you just got to find the right weirdos who like this, and it would have become a franchise where they're like, yes, give us more Cleopatra 2525. They would have had, like, Ramses 2535. It would have been a whole cinematic universe if it would have gotten, you know, taken off with Americans. But, you know, it's close as we'll have to an American Doctor Who.
Are there gimp suits in Doctor Who, too? Or
maybe. Tabitha.
I honestly think if we had just watched the first two episodes, I might have considered this a guilty pleasure, because I was not so much entertained as I was just like, this is kind of fun and mindless. And it also was giving me, like, very, very early, like, season one, episode, like, 1-4 of Buffy vibes with, like, the way they were talking and, like, the way it was filmed and, like, the terrible, like, fight scenes. Like, it was kind of giving Buffy. And then that third episode happened. I don't trust shit that comes after that. So I'm out. Dumpster fire.
Matt.
So I hadn't said this yet because I was kind of saving this point until we get to the end, but for a show that was supposed to be about the strength of women fighting to save the human race, there is so much like the gratuitous butt shot. And the skimpy outfits and her being a stripper. It's like,
I mean, it was still written by a guy.
You're doing this wrong. Like,
the misogyny wasn't internalized.
Right? For strong female characters, you're doing it wrong. You didn't understand the assignment.
It does pass the Bechdel test, though.
That's fair.
It does.
Yeah.
I hate that you're right about that. I can't disagree with Tabitha and Not Seth in regards to having early Buffy, early Doctor Who type of vibes. to a degree. But I also think that, yes, that third episode is what sent it off the rails and puts this squarely in the category of a dumpster fire.
Lydia.
So, I had so many emotions watching this show. Also, watching this, I feel like I randomly actually saw this on TV in the early 2000s. like my dad had like the Sci-Fi Channel on or something. I don't remember a bunch about it, but like I have that like slight familiarity like in the back of my head. Like I've seen this before and I don't remember why. The first two episodes, yeah, like it's kind of mindless. It's campy. I enjoyed it. And then we hit that third episode and now I'm not sure how I feel. But at the same time, I want to keep watching and see what the heck is going to happen. You came up with the perfect analogy for me. What was it? Because it's like it's a dumpster fire, but it's also a guilty pleasure, and I'll keep watching.
Oh yeah, it's like it's the train wreck that you can't stop watching.
Yes.
So I know you didn't watch it, but based off of everything that you've listened to today, Kevin.
Oh, I would definitely go guilty pleasure just for the 90-minute show that I got. I was watching Lydia stare at her phone because, no, she cried, she laughed, she got angry. Like.
I had all the emotions, guys.
I have been, basically, since we finished the third episode on Monday, I have been going back and forth on whether or not I think this is a guilty pleasure or a dumpster fire. Guilty pleasure or a dumpster fire. And I am landing on guilty pleasure. This especially... Yeah, you guys are 100% right. That third episode is just bonkers. And I'm not talking about that cartoon. But yeah, just like insane. But, like, there is a slight part of me that wants to, like, finish this series, especially with it only being two seasons. Like, you got this, bro. There are less than 30 episodes. You can do it.
I'll tell you what, I'll watch it with you.
Done.
Report back.
But, yeah, like, I want to see, especially if like with that last episode where, you know, Cleopatra was trying to change the others, you know, like I want to see, does she grow? Does she become more independent? Does she become less screamy?
Please.
Please. But yeah, I mean, I'm fine with being, you know, in the losing. I guess technically it's tied. Kevin, Evan, or not Seth and I all said,
I'll say I'll go guilty pleasure too.
Okay.
Because I do want to watch it more.
This is
going to be.
This is firmly in the guilty pleasure camp.
Sorry, guys.
So we've got one last story. I know we've talked a lot tonight. But Tabitha, you have a story about something that happened during the recent earthquake in New York.
You asked me to find a weird story.
I did.
You did. And I provided.
You understood the assignment.
I did. There were a plethora of options that I had uncovered, but I felt like because the earthquake just happened, it felt timely. The headline of this article is, "Man getting vasectomy when earthquake hit, thought doctor was making a joke." His post on X, formerly known as Twitter, is what has garnered this kind of national coverage. I'm just going to read it. Not going to censor myself. I'm going to drop an F-bomb here. A fucking earthquake happened in the middle of my vasectomy. That's all he said. So Justin Allen went into his procedure in Horsham, Pennsylvania. He is a father of two. And 33 years old, and decided that was enough chitlins. So he went in for his snip snip with his doctor. right around the time that that earthquake hit the East Coast at 10:23 a.m., the doctor was actively in the middle of the suturing. The cauterizing. And it was about 10 minutes in. And at first, the doctor, or at first he thought like they were close to like a train station or there was something else that was like causing the shaking in the room, because he didn't think it was an earthquake because earthquakes never hit the East Coast, right? And then all of a sudden his surgeon, I guess, stops and goes, wait, is that an earthquake? And he thought the surgeon was making a dick joke to lighten the mood. But then they realized it was an earthquake. They could not stop or move. The doctor just had to pause mid-activity until the shaking stopped, which was, you know, like a couple of seconds later. And then they just proceeded on with his vasectomy and sent him on his merry little way. He said it is a experience he is never going to forget. But there have been over 5,000 reposts of his Twitter, X, whatever, including someone retweeting it and saying, Mother Nature with the best D's nuts joke in human history. So he's okay. His doctor took it in stride. I was thinking
gross.
About I was thinking about that, like when they were talking about the earthquake, because like that area is like home to like a lot of like major medical centers, and I was like, I hope no one was in the middle of like heart surgery. I had that thought. I don't know if they were, but this guy was in the middle of nut surgery, and that sucks. Are you okay, Matt?
No.
You're very pale.
I'm very uncomfortable. Oh, that sounds that sounds so painful.
I mean, he definitely shouldn't have to worry about having kids anymore.
Unless the doctor missed. Uh-huh. The shaking was happening, and right? Now he's got to go have it done again.
The burning.
Are you having a flashback?
I am.
Okay.
I don't want to talk about it.
See what you have to look forward to, Kevin?
Bag of peas is preferable.
True.
I just... So, like, granted, I don't know, like, how people are situated during that type of procedure.
Matt, do you care to share with the class?
Kevin, my
I how do I say it? Balls out? Like, I mean, <that's>
but, like,
you're laying, though, right?
You're laying down, okay. And it's... Yeah, like feet out and pulled back some
stirrups.
I was gonna say, yeah, so like it's stirrups like when you're having a kid.
Yeah.
But yeah, just to like, but for me, just like the idea of like, okay, we just have to hang out here, literally. but like,
the
that's
whole
just,
conversation.
That's just awkward for me.
I mean, it's your doctor. He was already looking at it. Like, it's not.
Yeah,
like...
but like, he is now looking at it for longer than he needed to.
It, like, it's exactly as long as he needed to. No more, no less.
Like, sir, did you realize you had a mole there? Sorry.
But like, I just. Yeah, I just. What do you two talk about, like, while that's going on? And, like, you know, you're just hanging out there.
We're having, isn't it?
Small talk.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully not too small. Hopefully like, just a totally average length like, of discussion.
Like the kind of questions that your dentist asks you.
When your mouth's full?
Yes.
I hope your mouth's not full during that.
Nobody's got you by the balls.
Literally.
All right. Well, between this conversation and Cleopatra 2525, we need to all sit in silence and think about what we've done.
Maybe take a shower.
Maybe yes. Take a shower. Yes. Yeah. So, to the next time you hear from us, we will be at C2E2, and hopefully talking about much nicer things. So, everybody, say bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
's going to do it for this episode of The Geek Awakens. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, shoot us an email at thegeekawakenspodcast@gmail.com.
It would be a shame if you didn't follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Geek Awakens Podcast or on Twitter at Geek Awakens.
Theme music created and produced by E. Cannon Beats.
Our logo was designed by Shay McCain.
Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time. We're boldly gone.